underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Writer Tracy Chevalier spins fiction from history. She authored the best-selling Girl with a Pearl Earring, set in the 17th century art studio of Vermeer. Her new novel, At the Edge of the Orchard, takes us back to the Gold Rush era to tell the tale of a pioneer family on the American frontier. It goes from Ohio in 1838 to the get-rich-quick culture of San Francisco in the 1850s, telling the story of the Goodenough family, whose own cross-country migration embodies that American need to move west to escape the troubles of the past. The name again of the book is At the Edge of the Orchard, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Tracy Chevalier to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It seems as though you've long had this interest in trees and their meaning to us.
Yes, my husband is on the board of a charity in the UK called the Woodland Trust, which is concerned with replanting trees. Britain has been kind of deforested over the years. It has the least amount of forests or woodland of any of the European countries, I think, and they're trying to change that. And so John would come back from his board meetings and talk to me about trees, and when we'd go for walks, he'd point out little facts and things, and it all sunk in over the years. And eventually I edited a book of contemporary fables about trees for the Woodland Trust. It was a kind of fundraiser. And I discovered I really liked writing about trees and editing other people's writing about trees. It made me start thinking about my own relationship with trees, like the trees from my childhood in particular. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and we had this big backyard that had a beech tree in it that I learned how to climb when I was 5 years old. And I can still remember. It's almost like a physical imprint in me that remembers where the branches are, how to get up into it. There was a particular technique. And I have a really kind of visceral connection to that tree over all these years. And when I started talking to people about trees, they'd often mention trees from their childhood. And I thought, what would it be like to grow up growing trees, getting to know trees intimately the way you would with an orchard? And So the Goodenough family who settle in Ohio, they become very connected to the land and to those particular trees. So it went hand in hand with my own interest in trees to write about them.
At the Edge of the Orchard takes place in the mid-19th century in Ohio and further west during the California Gold Rush. What do we know about how apple trees got to this country? Because I was surprised to read that we have really no indigenous apples in the United States.
Yeah, I was surprised by that too, because they seem so American. You know, American is apple pie. And also, I live in England, and we have a similar feeling there. There are certain types of apples you just think, oh, they've always been here, haven't they? But actually, apples come from Kazakhstan and Central Asia, and they came along the Silk Trade route. Well, like along that area about 2,000 years ago, and they ended up in Persia, and then down through towards where is now Italy. And eventually the Romans brought them to Great Britain, and they grew there. And then English settlers, when they came over to America, brought trees with them. And that was how apple trees got to the States, which I find really remarkable. And it made me, when I was starting to look into it, it made me realize that trees actually migrate the way people do, alongside people. And so this is a book about migration. It's about people moving around, trying to find a better life, escaping the past. And the trees kind of go along with them. And there's a trade in trees. So we have Johnny Appleseed, who's moving apple trees around Ohio and into Indiana. And then eventually, one of the Goodenough family, Robert Goodenough, who's a boy in the first part of the book, he grows up and he ends up in California, Gold Rush, California. And he meets a man there named William Lobb, who is an English plant collector, who himself is sending trees and tree seeds back to, to England for Victorian gardeners to grow in their yards and their gardens. And so again, there's this kind of commerce in trees and moving trees around. And you can still see, William Lobb really existed, and you can still see in England when you're going around. Sometimes you'll see redwoods and sequoias and ponderosa pines and think, how did they get here? They're from America, but they moved with people.
Do you like having real characters like William Lobb in your novels?
I do, because, first of all, they provide a sort of anchor to the book. So I have two people who really existed, Johnny Appleseed, whose name was John Chapman, and William Lobb, and they anchor the two sections of the book. They are facts about them that I can grasp onto, that I can do research and sort of stick them as poles into the two sections of the book, so that these are facts and information that I can hang on to. And I like that, because it kind of grounds me as a writer to have something. Because, you know, as a writer, you can choose to do anything. And sometimes that wide choice can be paralyzing, because it's anything is possible. And because anything is possible, you can't think of anything. Whereas if you ground it in some sort of reality, then that gives you some boundaries. So for instance, I wanted to write about giant sequoias, and they were first discovered in 1852, and William Lobb went to see them in 1853. And when I found that out, I thought, okay, I'm going to set the book then, at that time, that summer of 1853, and I'm going to bring Robert Goodenough, my made-up character, and have him meet the real person in this grove called Calaveras Grove. And I may not have thought to do that at that particular time and that particular place, except that it actually existed. So those sort of details ground it. The other thing about having real people in the book is that they bring a kind of verisimilitude to the rest of the novel, mm-hmm. so that I may weave in fiction, but it's woven together with fact, and hopefully the reader believes me enough, because I can talk with some authority about these real figures, and that extends out to the stuff that I've made up.
Tracy Chevalier is the author of At the Edge of the Orchard, a novel. It is published by Viking. Goodenough and Lobb shipped sequoia and redwood seedlings and saplings from San Francisco to England. How did they survive that trip?
Good question. And that was where a lot of research came in. In the early days, when plant collectors were sending things back by ship, a lot of stuff arrived dead, because you can't keep them out on deck. They get sprayed by the sea spray. The salt in the water can kill a plant. And so they had to be kept below deck. But then you'd have to bring them up so that they could get some sunlight. So the whole thing was very labor intensive. I mean, can you imagine sailors actually wanting to lug these plants out? They had other things to do with
right.
their time. So it was really tricky. And this thing, someone invented, must have been Ward invented this. There was the Ward's case, which is basically like a big terrarium, or if you think of a mini greenhouse built out of glass and wood. And you put dirt in there, and then you plant the plants in it. And then you put water in it, and you lock it down, and it's airtight. The plants survive through condensation. Like, they just kind of regenerate the water over and over again. It doesn't evaporate, because it's all sealed tight. You can keep them on deck if it's not too rough, because then they get sunlight. You could just leave them out there as long as you don't shatter the case. They can survive very well. And in fact, that's how a lot of things got moved. I think those were invented in the 1840s, so that made it a lot easier. But one of the reasons I wanted to write about redwoods and sequoias is that I discovered this redwood grove on the border between England and Wales about 25 years ago. I saw it. There are 33 redwood trees growing there. They're about 150 years old. And the accounts from how they were brought over said that they were brought in pails on a ship from California. So I used this in the end of the book. Robert Goodenough gets involved with William Laub, and they end up bringing these little saplings, little seedlings, in pails. And that's quite labor-intensive, so they didn't use a Ward's case. But I rather like the idea of them having to do it in a very basic way.
Who was Laub's employer in wanting these, knowing that there was a market in the UK for these seedlings?
There was a nursery in Exeter in south of England run by a man named James Veitch, and it became known as the nursery to go to get exotic plants. So Veitch sent out plant collectors, including William Laub and his brother Thomas Laub. Thomas Laub went to Asia and sent back all kinds of orchids and things like that. And then William Laub went to South America and North America and sent back things like the monkey puzzle tree from Chile, which you see all over England now. And that was based on the seeds he sent back. And then he came to North America specifically to look for conifers, for firs and pines, evergreen trees that people in England really wanted in their gardens. I mean, if you think about kind of upper class, big estate, something like Downton Abbey, that kind of big land, there are very few UK native species of conifers. And what the Victorian gardeners and the owners of these big properties decided, there became this craze for getting evergreens in because most of the trees in England were deciduous. So in the winter, in the fall and the winter, when the leaves would come down, the garden would look really bare. And they said, if we got an evergreen, so we can do all kinds of structural stuff. It'll look really beautiful all year round rather than just in spring and summer. So there was this kind of craze for conifers, and Veitch cottoned on to that, and he sent Laub specifically to California and Oregon to bring these trees back.
As you mentioned, these 33 still exist. So after 150 years, and we realize only 150 years, how are they holding up? Much smaller than what we would be used to in the Redwoods.
Yeah, they look good. It's a surprise to see them. It's wonderful to see that kind of tawny bark in amongst more normal trees. They are, of course, smaller because the redwoods you see in California are, you know, can be thousands of years old and really, really tall. And these aren't so tall, but they're getting there, slowly getting there. And then there's also the giant sequoias, which are like redwoods, except they're not quite as tall. And they're the ones that have those enormous trunks that are like 30 feet across. Like if you've ever been out there and you see where they've cut out a passage for the cars to go through, those are usually giant sequoias. And they were brought back also to England, and you see them also looking lovely, but they're not as huge. I mean, we need 1,000 years for that. And that was one of the things I rather loved about it all, is these gardeners hearing about this massive trees. Like William Laub took saplings and seedlings and seeds from sequoias back to England himself because he knew they would be popular, but he also thought, nobody's going to believe me unless I'm actually there to show them my sketches and explain just how huge these trees are. And they did become immediately popular, but you know, it's going to take 1,000 years before a tree is going to get that big. So gardeners have to have a really, really look way ahead and know that they're, for these trees, their grandchildren certainly aren't going to see them huge. It'll take many, many, many generations of descendants before they're going to see anything like what you see in California.
The novel is At the Edge of the Orchard. It is published by Viking. Tracy Chevalier is our guest on the book show. Let us go back for a moment to John Chapman, better known as Johnny Appleseed. And here is a character that has this myth that has grown up around him, of course, of an eccentric wearing a tin pot on his head and promoting healthy eating and, of course, spreading these apple seeds. The truth, as you write, is, and as you mentioned, here was a guy who was basically in it for the alcohol and kind of comes off as the local drug dealer.
Yes, I know. But, you know, what's so surprising is that that he ever was chosen as the poster boy for healthy eating. It's very odd. It was the Women's Temperance Society, I think, probably a good 50 years after his death, they were coming down hard on orchardists for supplying all these apples for making cider. They wanted to cut down on that. And I don't know why they chose Johnny Appleseed, but they did. They said, look, he promoted healthy eating, so you should be growing and selling more sweet apples rather than sour apples. And that's how the myth of Johnny Appleseed grew long after his death. And the reality is that he, as you say, he was kind of the, not exactly the drug dealer, but kind of. He did supply a lot of apples that were made into alcohol that settlers were using to drink away their hard lives, because their lives were really hard. Now, the Goodenough family settle in an area of Ohio, in northwest Ohio, just south of Toledo, called the Black Swamp. And they end up there because it's the part of Ohio that was settled after everything else, and they couldn't find any other land. So they ended up in the place no one else wanted to go. And there's so much mud there, so many mosquitoes, there's swamp fever, very few people, very hard to grow anything. It's a miserable life. So in some ways, it's no surprise that they would try to anesthetize themselves a bit against the hardships.
Let me ask you about some of the characters in this book, and I'll pick one, Sadie Goodenough. Having a character like this that has such a unique and interesting voice, and what it is like to write that and how fully formed that comes to you versus a character that is a bit more quieter.
Oh, Sadie Goodenough is the wife of James Goodenough, and they have 10 children, 5 who die of swamp fever. So she's the mother figure of the family. And she's really unhappy. She's basically an alcoholic. And she's cruel. She's a terrible mother, terrible wife. And she came out of me fully formed. Most of the rest of the book is told in third person, but Sadie is such a strong character that I had to let her tell her story in her own voice. So her sections are first person. And it's always hard to know whether readers are going to, how they'll respond to a character who is so awful like that. But I wanted to also show that she was could be a sympathetic character too. She's one of those people who's so self-centered and difficult, and yet there are moments of pathos, and she clearly made the wrong marriage. She married the wrong man, and she's settled in this place she hates. At one point she says, oh, please, I've heard about this place called Prairie. Please can we go out there where there are no trees, because I hate trees. And you know she's never going to get to the prairie. And there's also an isolation she senses from the neighbors don't like her, or the community doesn't like her, even her own family are kind of isolate her. And she finds this really painful. She's like a kind of like a child. And I hope that there is some balance there, that you can find some sympathy for her, even as you're marveling at just how horrific she is.
And when you have other characters that are, as I said a moment ago, a little quieter, is that more difficult to bring out the voice?
Yes, sometimes. Certainly James Goodenough, Sadie's husband, is in marked contrast to her, is much quieter. And their son, Robert, who ends up going to California, is also quiet. And in some ways, because the escalation of the battle between the parents, it escalates and it's quite violent, and it affects Robert tremendously, so that he ends up kind of fleeing west. And in a way, he's so quiet and sort of passive. It's like he's trying so hard to get away from what has happened to his family that he allows life to happen to him instead of him taking charge. And the book is about his journey to finding a way to accepting what's happened in the past and moving on, and becoming his own driver, his own person. It's very tricky to write it because it's a lot more subtle than Sadie. Sadie hits you over the head, whereas Robert and his father, to an extent, are much quieter, and it's a more subtle transition that he makes. And I think what I tended to do with both of them was focus on their relationship to nature and to the trees around them and to their love of trees. So that really comes out very strongly. And so that provides a kind of solid foundation that makes it easier to understand their characters.
I assume it's not a coincidence that for many of us who are going to read this novel, in my reading of it, I came out thinking of my childhood and reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, that time and place and that lifestyle was something you wanted to explore, and I assume were influenced by.
Yes, I loved Laura Ingalls Wilder as a child, and I reread the books while I was writing this book. And it was interesting because anytime you go back to books you loved as a kid and you read them as an adult, of course, you're going to look at them in a very different way.
Sure.
And so when I was a girl, I loved Laura. I thought she's a wonderful character. I focused much more on the children. And this time around, I was paying a lot more attention to the parents and what they went through. And particularly the mother, Caroline Ingalls, is so patient with the girls, with her daughters, and also with her husband. Charles Ingalls is always restless, and it seems like they have a decent life somewhere, and then he says, no, we're moving, we want more land, can't stand all these neighbors. And I just thought, oh, she's having to put up with this. And of course, it's as an adult perspective, because I'm a wife and a mother myself now, and so I look at it more from that point of view. And I think after reading them, I thought, well, what I really want to do is I'm recognizing, like reading between the lines, that life was not so easy and romanticized as Laura Ingalls Wilder might have written it for children. Mm. So maybe I'm writing the dark side of the Ingalls family is the good enoughs, and how this pioneer life is actually really harsh and cruel, and it makes people harsh and cruel the way Laura Ingalls Wilder never really presented in her books. So I'm doing the kind of anti-heroine in Sadie versus Caroline Ingalls.
You get that sense about Laura Ingalls Wilder in reading Pioneer Girl, this nonfiction account of
yes.
her life.
Yes, I reread the books, and at the same time, Pioneer Girl came out last year, and
right.
it was a first time publication of the memoir Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote originally about her growing up.
That's
on
pretty
the
remarkable.
Prairie. It is, because what happened was she sent it to an editor thinking that she wanted to publish that, and the editor wrote back and said, I want you to make these stories into books for children. And that's what she ended up doing. And so you get the kind of raw material that she then fashioned these novels out of. And I was interested in what she left out. So she clearly had an agenda with her children's books, that her father could do no wrong, that the family was very close and tight-knit and happy, and moving west was always a good thing, and that they only ever moved west. Whereas in the reality of it was that at one point they did move east. They moved back to Iowa, and they ended up working in a hotel for a year, which was just full of drunken men who were always fighting. And one guy supposedly set himself on fire from having drunk so much. He lit a cigar, and the alcohol fumes set him on fire. And Mary and Laura had to work in the hotel and see all of this. And in the middle of it all, they had a baby brother, and the baby brother died. Laura never mentions this in any of her books, in any of her children's books. And I think it's not that she sanitized her life, but that she chose deliberately to emphasize this idea, the sort of libertarian idea of moving west, individual freedom, and this is what we always did. Well, it's not what they always did.
My final question to you is one that I just wrote in the margin of the book as I was reading it, because it came to my mind, and I can't let it go. So, and that is, given the Dickensian flair, the Dickensian sense of the name Goodenough, is that a name you would have given these characters if you didn't live in London?
I don't know. That's a good question. I can't even remember where I found the name, but I normally find my names by when I'm doing research. I keep a little names list in the back of my research notebook. So it's just whatever names I come across. I write down first names and I write down last names. And I just found Goodenough a wonderful name. It's such a burden of a name, mm-hmm. because nobody ever really expects that much from you. You just do Goodenough. And And I thought, what would it be like to have that name? But yes, I suppose it is quite Dickensian, so I've let slip my little bit of Englishness coming through. But yes, I don't know what I would have called them if I had always lived in the States. Maybe Smith or Jones.
Or Appleseed, something like that.
Or Apple, yes, yes.
Tracy Chevalier's new novel is At the Edge of the Orchard. It is published by Viking. Tracy Chevalier, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.